The year 2016 was noted for the number of celebrity deaths. But in the sciences, there was one loss that was particularly notable. On this episode of Blue Dot, we look back at the life of astronomer Vera Rubin. Her pioneering work on the rotation of galaxies led to the discovery of dark matter. She also blazed a trail for other women to follow in the male-dominated field of astrophysics. We're joined by her colleague, former student, Risa Wexler. Join us now. Nolan, have you ever heard of dark matter?
Yes, I have. I believe it does not emit or absorb light, but we don't know exactly what it is.
Yes, but it turns out that the universe is composed mostly of this stuff that we cannot directly detect, rather than the normal matter that you and I and this desk and microphone and everything around us are made of.
So who are we talking to today?
We're going to talk to one of Vera Rubin's colleagues and a person that was very influenced by her life and work, Risa Wexler. She's an astrophysicist in the Department of Physics at Stanford University. I'd like to start with talking about you. You have a pretty awesome resume. Tell us just a bit about how you became a professor of physics at Stanford.
Sure. Well, I was pretty interested in math and all kinds of science when I was a kid. My stepfather actually had a nice telescope, so we used to look at planets and moons in the backyard, and I also remember playing with a great chemistry set in my basement. They don't make them like that anymore with all the explosions you can make. I decided I wanted to be a physicist around age 16. I really hadn't had much formal exposure to it. But I got interested in physics because I really liked the big questions. I really liked these questions about what the universe is made of, how do things work on the largest scales and on the smallest scales, how did everything form, how does everything work. So those were the kinds of questions that I got interested in, and it was not an easy path from there to where I ended up, but I'm pretty stubborn, so I just kept going. I ended up going to college at MIT. It seemed like the place to go to really be exposed to cutting-edge scientists and be surrounded by scientists. And I had had some great math and biology classes in high school, but I really didn't learn a lot of physics there. So my first physics courses at MIT were pretty challenging. But I just kept going. After that, I went to grad school at UC Santa Cruz. I had decided sort of during the time that I was an undergrad that I wanted to do cosmology and astrophysics, and so that was a great place to go to do that work. I was in the physics department, but I really benefited from a very strong astronomy department at UC Santa Cruz. And I did my PhD there, and then I did postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Michigan and the University of Chicago. At the time that I was looking for faculty jobs, I was really lucky that Stanford had just started a new institute in astronomy and cosmology. That started in 2003, and then I was sort of the third junior person hired as part of that institute, so that was a great opportunity, and I was really sort of thrilled to make it back to California and to such an amazing institution. So,
yeah, Stanford's
short story.
Stanford's a wonderful place to be, and the Bay Area is a neat place to live.
Oh, it's fantastic. I love it here.
How did you first become aware of Vera Rubin, and what kind of role did she play in inspiring your career path?
I think I first learned about her work when I was taking my first astronomy class, so that was my first year in college at MIT. And I think it was just really fantastic to learn about her groundbreaking work. It was clear even from that vantage point, sort of how much courage it took, not only because she was pretty much the only woman working at that level, but because she was just really doing something new. There was new instrumentation. She figured out what she could do with that new instrument. She figured out, what she was most curious about that no one else was working on, and she just went for it. A lot of her early work people were pretty skeptical of, and she just kept going and got more data. So I found that really impressive. I think the way that she just kept being driven by answering questions about the universe and kept going was really impressive. When I got to graduate school, I collaborated also with Sandy Faber, who's another very well-known female astronomer. And Sandy had worked with Vera when she was young, and Vera supported her and opened doors for her like she did for a lot of other scientists. So I met her personally once I was more established and working in the field already, but just knowing of her work when I was, you know, starting out and just kind of the way she did science was really an inspiration.
I saw that she wanted to become an astronomer from a very early age. Could you tell us about the difficulty of being a woman wanting to be an astronomer when she was getting going?
Well, things were obviously quite a bit different when Vera started in the field than they are now. One of the things I found impressive, I learned in an interview, she said it just didn't occur to her to that she couldn't be an astronomer, even though she didn't know any astronomers. You know, she tells a story of just looking out her bedroom window when she was a kid and trying to understand how the stars were moving and, you know, really just literally making maps of what was happening when she was a kid. And that, you know, is really what she ended up doing through most of her career, essentially making maps of how the stars were moving. She did face a lot of barriers. She decided to go to Vassar for college, largely because she had heard of a woman astronomer who had been there, the very, very well-known astronomer Maria Mitchell, who was known for discovering comets. But then when she tried to, you know, was looking at going to graduate school, she thought about going to Princeton. She asked them for a catalog, and they wouldn't even send her a catalog because they didn't admit women at the time. So that's one example. Another example that just kind of shows you about the kinds of barriers she must have faced is she once went to chat with the very well-known astronomer George Gamma, and they had to meet in the lobby because women weren't allowed upstairs in the building.
Wow.
So, you know, that's just a kind of an example. I think there's this amazing, there's this amazing article. She first appeared in the Washington Post in 1950, after her first public presentation. It was a presentation she gave at the American Astronomical Society. And it was, you know, on her thesis work, and it was fairly provocative, controversial work. But the article in the Washington Post actually, first of all, gets her name spelled wrong, but second of all, primarily focuses on the fact that she's a young mother. It does turn out that she brought her 3-week-old child to the meeting, but focused on that and also on the sort of the controversy of what she had presented there. So,
as we delve into her groundbreaking work, we're going to be talking a lot about dark matter and dark energy in the next couple of minutes. Could you give us a brief overview, a little primer on what we know about them?
Absolutely. So dark matter, which is the stuff that Vera really found the first evidence for around galaxies, dark matter is something that doesn't emit or absorb light. So what we can do is we can see its impact gravitationally. Whatever dark matter is, and in fact we still don't know what it is, but whatever it is, we think that it behaves gravitationally just like normal matter. The difference between dark matter and normal matter is that while normal matter can emit or absorb light, dark matter doesn't do that. Our best guess is that dark matter is some kind of particle, and we are looking for what that particle is. Theorists come up with new ideas about what that particle can be, and astronomers are trying to map out in detail, you know, how dark matter is distributed in the universe, and we've actually made a tremendous amount of progress on that particular task. And we're also looking with particle physics experiments for finding what that dark matter is. But basically, you know, one of the things that we are clear on is we know very well, even though we don't know what it is, we know very well how much there is, and we actually know a lot about how it's distributed in the universe. So we know that it's about 85% of the mass in the universe, and that's about 25% of the total mass and energy in the universe. So, you know, it is really the thing that controls how galaxies form and how stuff evolves in the universe. Dark energy is something a bit different. Dark energy, unlike dark matter, it's not matter at all. So it's not something that interacts gravitationally the same as normal matter. We're also not sure what dark energy is. What we do know very clearly, we know that there is this extra energy in the universe because that impacts the geometry of the universe. And we also know that the dark energy is causing the universe's expansion rate to speed up with time. And so that that measurement that the universe's expansion is actually accelerating was done in the late 1990s and has now been really mapped out with increasing precision. And so that's really telling us that, you know, there has to be some property of space that is making the universe expand faster and faster with time. If you had a universe which is only made of matter, then that can't happen.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio, and we're talking to Risa Wexler about the life of Vera Rubin, astronomer extraordinaire. Let's talk about her importance in astronomy, because it really can't be overstated that she was one of the titans of 20th century astronomy. She was studying the rates of rotation of galaxies and found a very surprising observation. Can you explain to us what she observed and why it was so remarkable?
Yes, absolutely. So first, what Vera was looking at, she was interested in learning about galaxy dynamics, basically how galaxies move. And what she first started looking at, essentially our nearest neighbor galaxy, Andromeda, or M31. And the surprising thing that she found was that stars in the outer parts of that galaxy were moving a lot faster than you would have expected from the light alone. So if you have a system that is bound by gravity, how much mass you have determines how fast something is moving. So if you think, for example, about the solar system, planets that are much farther away from the sun are moving slower around the sun than planets in the inner regions. And the surprising thing is that what Vera measured was that was not true in galaxies. In galaxies, the stars on the outskirts of the galaxy are basically moving exactly as fast as the stars kind of in the middle of the galaxy. And that is really implying that there has to be something else out there that is different from the stars that are emitting light and that we can see. And after Vera measured that in one galaxy, she went on to make similar measurements in tens of galaxies and eventually a few hundred galaxies. And the remarkable thing is that essentially every single one of those galaxies had those features. So there was some initial discussion of the possibility of dark matter. The first person to actually propose that term was Fritz Zwicky in the 30s, doing a similar kind of measurement. Instead of looking at how galaxies move, how stars in galaxies move, he was looking at how galaxies move in an individual galaxy cluster, so a group of hundreds of galaxies. And he also found that they were moving in a way that implied more stuff there. But I think at that time it was only one system, and that work was really not widely accepted or appreciated for decades until Vera did this work. And I think what Vera's work really showed in this amazing way is that this dark matter was everywhere. It was around every single galaxy. And in our current understanding, we actually think that the dark matter is essentially required in order for galaxies to form. You need that extra mass there in order to get things dense enough so that gas can cool and form stars. So it's our understanding of dark matter is really kind of central now to our entire understanding of almost everything in cosmology and astrophysics. It is the thing that determines the overall dynamics of the universe, how structures form on very large scales, and it also determines how, you know, individual galaxies form. So it's really central to so much of how we understand how the universe works today.
Galaxies are such huge structures so far away, and, you know, it takes millions of years for stars to complete an orbit around the core of them. Could you explain how she made those kinds of measurements and how you can tell that kind of thing in human timeframes?
Yeah, so she was using a new instrument. It was called the spectrograph. That was a spectrograph on the Palomar telescope. So you aren't measuring the stars moving large distances directly. But with a spectrograph, what you can see is you can see how fast something is moving away from you or occasionally towards you, effectively by looking at the wavelengths of light that come from different parts of the galaxy. So she was able to use that spectrograph to see how things were moving in the inner parts of galaxies and then all the way out to the edge of the galaxies, at least to the edge of where the stars can be seen. And those measurements, so essentially what she was able to map out was how fast the stars were rotating as a function of the distance from the center of the galaxy. And she was able to then do that in, you know, in a few hundred systems.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. And when we come back, we'll continue our look at the life of astronomer Vera Rubin with her colleague and student Risa Wexler. And we're back talking to Risa Wexler, astrophysicist from the Department of Physics at Stanford University. And we're talking about the life and work of the late Vera Rubin. I find it hard to believe that a discovery like dark matter, which you just explained so beautifully, is like central to how the universe works, wasn't worthy of a Nobel Prize in physics. Am I alone in that opinion?
No. You're definitely not alone in that opinion. I share that opinion. I think I would say that most astronomers and cosmologists, at least the ones that I've discussed this with, think that she did deserve a prize for this work. As we discussed, you know, it's really hard to overstate how central dark matter is to our modern understanding of physics and cosmology and astrophysics. And, you know, I mean, there are entire large experimental collaborations of thousands of people who are looking for dark matter underground and at the LHC. There are, you know, many, many astronomers who are, you know, for whom it is central to what they are doing and what they are understanding. So I think it is, I think the work was really not only central to how we understand things, and so certainly at that level in terms of its importance, but also at that level in terms of her contribution and the originality of the work, and really how groundbreaking it was at the time, and how it really was her her creativity and her efforts to her technical abilities to do the work and that led to that understanding. So I think it's definitely at that level. You could make the criticism that because we still don't know what dark matter is, that nobody should be awarded the prize for it yet. But I think there's plenty of examples of the Nobel Prize being awarded for things like that. That's certainly true in the case of dark energy. We still don't know why the universe is accelerating, but three men got the Nobel Prize for that work in 1998. So, for the work they did in 1998.
My point. It seems kind of strange that, you know, they got the and a deserved Nobel Prize for discovering dark energy, and yet the person that discovered dark matter wasn't recognized.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It is worth noting that I think it's 203 people have been awarded the Nobel Prize in physics, and only two of them have been women. The last woman to have gotten the Nobel Prize was 53 years ago. So, I think there was, that added a extra bittersweetness to her death among many astronomers who, you know, who felt that that work should have been recognized and that she was, you know, certainly among the women physicists who deserve the Nobel Prize, you know, on the top of that list.
Maybe that's why Bob Dylan didn't go to Stockholm to pick up his
Maybe. That must be it.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about what she was like as a person. Did you have any experiences that come to mind you could share with us?
Yeah, well, the last time I had the opportunity to interact with Vera was in 2009. It was at a conference which was in honor of her 80th birthday. It was a really pretty special event. There were about 200 scientists there, and it was a real conference, you know, science conference, people giving talks about dark matter and its role in how galaxies form and behave and its role in the universe. And I think it's amazing how much of that work really wouldn't have been possible without the context that Vera set. I think one of the amazing things, sort of seeing Vera appreciate that community and interact with it, was just she was just to the end just driven by curiosity. She just wanted to know more about, you know, she wasn't really interested in this thing being about her or in any kind of, you know, glory or about her reputation. She was just interested in learning more about what was going on with galaxies and what was going on with dark matter. And she did speak some at that meeting about, you know, the challenges she had faced in her life. But I think one of the things that struck me then and other times that I have heard her talk about it is that she was just really good-natured about it. I mean, despite it being, I'm sure, pretty brutal at a lot of stages, she was still very good-natured about her own experiences, and yet at the same time really fighting for things to be better for other people. And one of the most impressive things that I found about Vera is that she just always took other people seriously as scientists, and that was true, you know, regardless of gender, regardless of age, regardless of reputation. And, you know, almost every person that I have talked to who has known Vera has that feeling about her, that she just took all scientists seriously, like they had something to contribute. She was always curious to know what other people thought. She was just more interested in learning more and in science for, you know, for understanding the universe than she was in, you know, kind of fame or some of the other things that people at that level sometimes are more interested in.
Things are a lot better for women in science in general, and specifically astronomy, thanks to Vera Rubin. But what are some of the challenges that women still face to become astronomers?
Well, things have certainly changed for the better since Vera started in science. And I would say that there aren't any formal barriers to women succeeding in physics and astronomy, but that doesn't mean that there aren't barriers. I think, you know, Vera herself pointed out that most people really need to be invited or encouraged to do science, and this happens much more frequently for men than it does for women. And I think that's still true today. I think that the biases that all of us have, really about internally and externally about what kind of people can become scientists, that really influences both what we think about ourselves, but also what we think about, you know, what other people are capable of. And, you know, in my field, it's still fewer than 10% women at my level. In fact, you know, the number of undergraduate women getting physics degrees is still about 20%. That number actually hasn't changed in the last 10 years. It is a bit better in astronomy than it is in physics at the PhD level and at the faculty level, but the numbers are still small. And so even for women starting in physics and astronomy now, they don't see very many examples of people like themselves in the field. And I think, you know, that can be very isolating. And, you know, there many people, you know, continue to have, you know, biases about what kind of people should be doing science. And I think that's one thing that Vera really, really fought for and, you know, I think did have a real impact on.
I'd like to know a bit about your work on dark matter and dark energy and cosmology. What are you currently working on?
I work on a lot of topics, but much of my current focus is on very large galaxy surveys. So we're basically using galaxies to trace out where all the matter is in the universe. And that can tell us about where the dark matter is and how it evolves, and also more about dark energy, because essentially how galaxies trace the dark matter structure is telling us about the expansion rate of the universe and how fast structure grows in the universe. So I work on, I do that work using a combination of large computer simulations where we are really using those simulations to start from the early part of the universe and evolve them forward until we, you know, get something that looks like the present-day universe filled with galaxies. And then we test those models with large surveys of galaxies. So I'm involved in a couple of large survey projects. One that's going on now is called the Dark Energy Survey. We're about halfway through our work on that survey, and it's really amazing. One of the things we're able to do with that survey is actually make maps of where the dark matter is in the universe. So we do that using a different technique than Vera was using. We do that using something called weak gravitational lensing, essentially using the idea that light actually travels around, travels on straight lines, but those straight lines get bent in space because when you have extra mass. So when you have a massive system around a galaxy, for example, light traveling around that bends a little bit. And so we can use that bending of light to actually make maps of where all the matter is in the universe, basically giving us maps of the dark matter. And then I'm also leading sort of a next-generation survey project called DESI, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. And in that case, instead of just taking pictures of galaxies, we're actually getting spectra, similarly to what Vera was doing, except for, you know, she got a few hundred. And with this survey, we will be getting about 35 million spectra of galaxies and quasars. So very exciting. We're really going to be able to make this beautiful map of the universe. So,
Before we go, real quick, any last thing you'd like us to know about the life and work of Vera Rubin?
Well, I think Vera just really embodied kind of the best of science, and she was, you know, an incredibly original thinker. She was really fearless, which just kind of impacted her ability to keep going when things got in her way. And she was just driven by curiosity. She was never convinced that she kind of had the final answer about things. She always wanted to learn from people around her, no matter who they were. I think science would be a better place if more scientists were like Vera. So she will be missed by a lot of people.
Dr. Risa Wexler, thank you for sharing your reflections with us today on Blue Dot.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks to our guest, Dr. Risa Wexler, astrophysics professor and researcher at Stanford University. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at NSPR News. And you can also follow Risa at Risa Wexler, W-E-C-H-S-L-E-R, or me at Dave Shlom. Blue Dot is co-produced and engineered by Nolan Ford. And for Nolan, whose knowledge of the universe is accelerating mysteriously, I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.